In fact, right after the show, I get my Laura Takes Me Back, and there's a whole lot of disability news, but you can go on Facebook and look at disability program news, and you'll get all the latest information on how to join that and what to do around that.
Wonderful.
Okay, we're wrapping it up, and I thank you so much for coming on, and we've got a lot of work to do.
We do. Thank you.
So, folks, join. Get your body out there, grab your people, and let's go and make it happen.
That's right.
Thank you, darlings.
Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. That was Disability Awareness, and up next at 11:30 is Voices for the Animals.
Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Within These Walls, September 28th at 7 p.m. at the Saruman House in Portland. Within These Walls is a thought-provoking presentation and conversation focused on the nature of solitary confinement and its prevalence in the American prison system. During the event, there will be performance and discussion elements. Again, that's Within These Walls, September 28th at 7 p.m. at the Saruman House, 5131 Northeast 23rd Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thousands of soldiers. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Full Gallop, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs through Saturday, October 8th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Full Gallop is a portrait of Diana Vreeland, who stood at the center of American style for five decades. As editor of Harper's Bazaar and Vogue magazines and as a member of the International Cafe Society, she chronicled the extraordinary people and events of her time. This play is a portrait of Vreeland at a turning point in her life. Again, that's Full Gallop, now through October 8th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to Voices for the Animals on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying her habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals. I'm Deb Stedman, your host, and we are honored to have with us today world-renowned author, ecologist, and activist, Dr. Carl Safina. Among his long list of accomplishments, Dr. Safina has written 7 books on the natural world, including his latest one, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Thank you for being our guest today, Doctor.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
Okay, and first off, I must tell you that your book is such a joy to read. It's incredibly informative and beautifully written with a genuine respect for the animals that you have so keenly observed. And so thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you very much. It's very kind.
Okay. All right, let's begin by hearing about which animals are the subject of this book, where you study them, and how you actually went about observing them.
Well, really, all animals, including us, are the subject of the book. The ones that I focus the most on, where I actually went into where they live, are African elephants in Kenya, wolves in Yellowstone, and killer whales of the Pacific Northwest in Washington State.
Okay, and then each of those places, there was a resident wildlife researcher that you were with and kind of showed you the ropes?
Oh, yeah. I couldn't possibly have written the book without being able to tap into all of the knowledge and insight of the researchers that were gracious enough to have me along with them.
Yeah. Now, you noted in your book that animals that live in stable, structured groups are quite similar to humans in many ways. Can you describe how?
Yeah, because we live in stable, structured groups. We live in groups where we understand who we are relative to one another and what our roles are. And we start out as little babies who really don't have much of a role, and then we grow into different roles that come and go during the course of our lifetimes. And there are some other animals whose lives are very much like that.
Yes, and you mentioned, for instance, in particular, that these three groups of animals all live in families. They have friends. They have enemies. They sometimes make alliances, and as you just referred to, they seem to have kind of a career arc. Some of them seemed destined for leadership roles, or they go through different phases in their lives.
Yeah, and some of them are ambitious, and some of them, try to get ahead. So you can see all of that in certain kinds of animals.
So there seem to be many parallels, and you also have observed that there are many behaviors among the elephants and the wolves and the killer whales that led you to believe that they experience a wide range of human-like emotions. Can you give us a few examples, or at least one example, in for each of those animals, where they express kind of emotion?
Many of these emotions are the emotions we all share. We have joy, and we have anger, we have fear, and we have the other motivating things like hunger and thirst. We understand where we are in our territory. The world looks familiar because we know where we are, and those kinds of things.
Yeah, one very poignant part in your book was talking about how the elephants in Amboseli Park in Kenya, how they have been observed actually what appears to be grieving when they lose a family member. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, when a family member is ill and collapses, or gets into really any kind of trouble, they try to help them. They try to help them back to their feet or get them out of whatever problem they're in. And at the end of life, when an elephant goes down, if it will not be roused because it's actually dying, once it passes, the elephants often hang around and they come back for visits every day for a little while, and then every little while for another little while. And they often interact with the bones of elephants and seem to recognize the bones of the elephants that they knew in life. They recognize them by their teeth and by their tusks, which are the parts where in life they would have best known that part of what is left of their remains. So it's a very amazing kind of a strange thing about elephants that they act that way.
Yes, they seem to remember. There's the adage about, elephants never forget, and it seems that that applies in terms of their emotional memories as well.
Yeah, they have incredible memories. They know hundreds of other elephants individually from other families, and You know, they know who they are and they know where they are.
Yes, and I think that's one of the main points of your book, if I might say, that, you know, through all your observations and all your years of studying, you have come to the conclusion that the animals that that we share the world with are not a matter of, you know, what or different species, but they are whos. They aren't whats. And you make the point in your book that animals should not be measured in terms of their similarity to humankind, but rather should be regarded as different nations. Can you explain that idea a little bit more for us?
Well, yeah, I mean, all these other species belong to the world, and they belong to the world every bit as much as human beings belong to the world. And so they deserve the ability to live and carry on as they are supposed to, and as until recently they have been able to. And what we do to other other species are the same kinds of things that we have done to other people when we found them. We've said, we don't need you and we'll take your land from you. We don't think your life is valid. We don't think that you are as capable of emotion or love or creativity as we are. We think that we are better, and therefore we can do anything we want with you. And that's the way we have treated everybody we've come in contact with, and we've certainly treated other species that way.
Yes, I don't think anybody would argue that point with you. And but on the other hand, almost everyone agrees that through the evolutionary process, we inherited from other animals our physical attributes, such as our skeletons, our organs, and our nervous system. However, you go on to say in your book that we humans have also inherited our consciousness, our thoughts, and emotions from non-human animals as well. Now, that's kind of a, you know, a different twist on things. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Well, it's absolutely weird and illogical to think that other animals who have eyes aren't aware and aren't seeing. They're not hearing anything. They're not smelling anything with their noses when it's so obvious that they do all of those things. And so, we have essentially the exact same nervous system. We have the same brain chemicals that create mood and motivation in us are the ones that are in them and their brains doing the same kinds of things. So you have to be completely delusional to think that there is something so tremendously different about people and our mental experience, and that all of a sudden all these other animals with brains and sense organs are unaware of anything, and we're the only ones that understand that we're here in the world.
Yeah, well, we are a self-centered bunch, aren't we? But you do point out that human brains do differ from those of whales and elephants, despite a relatively similar number of neurons in the brain's cortex. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, they all differ a bit. Human brains differ, elephant brains differ, whale brains differ, parrot brains differ. But they have many capabilities in common that are enabled by those brains, because the similarities greatly overwhelm the differences.
Yes, and you go on, and perhaps you've already made the point today, but I'll put it in a little bit different phrasing here, that species that have the most complex societies develop the most complex brains. Can you explain to us a little bit why that is?
Well, the question is, what is intelligence, and why are some animals intelligent or more intelligent than other animals? And the thing that seems to create intelligence, or create the evolutionary pressures to develop higher intelligence, our complex social structure. It seems that if you need to remember a lot of your companions, and you need to remember who's your friend and who's your enemy and who to watch out for and who did what for you and who did what against you, that is what drives the evolution of increasing intelligence.
Okay. But now, on the other hand, one thing you said in your book, which I think will come as kind of a surprise to our listeners, you were claiming or stating or observing how civilization has apparently dulled human senses and has actually reduced the human brain size. You want to go into that a little bit, because I think that will come as a surprise to most people.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at most wild animals, one of the things you can see, if you look, is that their senses are incredibly acute compared to humans. And if you look at the wild versus domestic forms of different animals, you can see that the senses of the wild forms are much more acute than the senses of the domestic forms. And that's because during the process of domestication, we wanted animals who would go along and get along and would not be too uppity and would be easy to manage and be able to live in densely crowded places where they don't really travel too much. And as we were doing that to other species by settling them onto farms, we were actually doing that to ourselves, settling ourselves onto farms.
What irony, huh? Yeah.
And what you can see is that there are a number of different things that happen to domestic animals, and over the course of the time of domesticating them, their faces get flatter, their teeth get smaller, their coats get more variable. They tend to be more interested in sexual behavior outside of the breeding season. They also get smaller brains. And if you compare the brain size of people nowadays to the brain size of Neanderthals, what you see is they had bigger brains than we do.
Oh, boy, there go a whole slew of jokes that people used to make about, you know, calling each other Neanderthals in a bad way. So.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Right. All right. We're going to take a short break now, so please stay tuned. We'll be back in just a few seconds. This is KBOO Portland, and you're listening to Voices for the Animals. We're talking with Dr. Carl Safina about his observations of elephants, wolves, and killer whales, as documented in his latest book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Dr. Safina, since the time of Descartes, there's been a lot of resistance within the scientific community to even acknowledge an animal's capacity to think or to feel. For instance, Jane Goodall was shunned by her peers for assigning names rather than numbers to the chimpanzees that she was studying. Please share your perspective on this subject, because I know it's quite a bit different.
Yeah, I think Descartes gets too much of the blame, because his view has been the view of many people for a long time. Period of time. And the idea was that if you don't compare animals with humans, you'll be more objective about what they're doing and why they're doing it and their behaviors and all those kinds of things. And that made a certain amount of sense, but it also hardened into a rule that was became kind of irrational. I mean, it's not more scientific to call a chimpanzee by a number than it is by a name. It introduces at least an equal but opposite bias, and that bias is that they can ever be like us, because we refuse simply to use the same words to describe what they're doing. When I was being taught animal behavior, I was taught this whole vocabulary to describe what they're doing. And basically the idea is you couldn't use any of the same words for what people do. So even if two animals were fighting over mates or fighting over food or in a territorial fight and you could see what they were doing and you understood why they were doing it, you could not use the word fighting. You had to say that they were engaging in agonistic behavior. What does agonistic mean? It was just made up to describe, guess what? Fighting.
Fighting.
I mean, it's nonsensical at that point. You know, it's good to say, okay, at the beginning of a new science, we're not going to assume anything. We're going to see what's happening. But to absolutely categorically refuse to use the same vocabulary makes it impossible to really understand what other animals are doing or why they're doing it, because you can never cross a certain line, and that's just a rule. It's not reality.
Yeah, all you're trying to do is state the obvious. Now, given what you just said and the way that you've expressed your own perspective, may I ask if your own views have been criticized by your peers?
Not too much. I mean, maybe to a very slight extent by one or two people, but I've been remarkably reinforced by some people I really admire who really love the book and love what I've had to say. So I have not been getting much pushback at all. I've been getting actually a lot of endorsement and encouragement, so that's been really great. And you know, the thing about names, just for example, if you could name a dog or a chimpanzee 13, or you could name them Amy, and you could name a bush 13 or Amy, and the bush would still seem like a bush to you. It wouldn't suddenly seem like a human being if you called the bush Amy, but we seem to be afraid that if we use the same vocabulary for other animals, we are going to start seeing similarities. And there are a lot of people who are just too threatened by that prospect, I guess.
Well, I'm glad that you're inching the scientific community forward in those terms. Now, given your findings that most, if not all, members of the animal kingdom possess some degree of consciousness, display at least a limited range of emotion, and clearly demonstrate a strong desire to live, what implications should that have for the way we humans treat non-human animals?
Well, at the risk of not answering you, I think the implications are quite obvious. But I think the main implication is that kindness matters a lot. And that animals who are treated well, I mean, treating animals well is better than treating animals miserably. And even if you're planning to kill animals to eat them, you have many animals in our food system are made to live much more miserably than they are made to die. The laws, the humane laws about actually killing them, seem to me much better than the laws about how they can be kept alive. So I think that almost everything about how we interact with the rest of the animal kingdom and other living things is really truly dysfunctional.
Yeah, and this is a very difficult topic and a difficult question, but do you have any suggestions how to awaken our own species to see the other animals for what, or rather who, they really are?
Well, I don't really know what the problem is, in a way, because they're there. The information is there. There's a lot more that we know about than ever in history. Anybody can watch incredibly well-done films about what animals do in the real world, and there's, you know, the research and the knowledge now is better than ever. And why many people just don't care about that, or they're too distracted, or there's too much competing stuff that gets their attention.
Yeah. We want to think we're special,
I
guess.
Really sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
We also have, we have incredibly ingrained institutions and customs and beliefs that undermine the ability to look at the world with a fresh and vivid and open mind.
Yeah. Okay. All over the world, people are becoming increasingly aware of the effects of climate change on the planet and all therein. Have the animals that you've studied been impacted in any noticeable ways yet? And if so, how are they coping with the rapid changes in their worlds?
Well, you see changes due to climate everywhere, and I've seen a lot of it. And we can see that the water temperatures in the ocean near where I live are changing a lot. If you go to the polar regions, you can understand that the ice is melting tremendously. The patterns of rainfall are changing. I mean, a lot of things are changing a lot. And on top of those changes, that in a wilder, more original world, climate changes happened over a very long period of slow time. And many animals adapted, many animals could not adapt, many animals had to move to different places. We see in the ocean right now, many fish and other ocean species are moving toward the poles and away from the equator to stay within their temperature range where their body works correctly. So you see all of those things. But on top of all of that, they have a problem that in many places, there's not really any place that they can go. And even without a change in the habitat or the rainfall patterns, there's not a lot of places where they can go because people are expanding into the remaining places that they live. And they're doing, people are doing that everywhere in the world. To either a total extent or to some extent, so we are really squeezing all of these other creatures, and we are in the we are in the process of causing one of the major extinctions in the history of the world. Yeah. And there's a great book about that by Elizabeth Colbert, The Sixth Extinction.
Yes, thanks for recommending that. I know it's a good one. All right, last question I think that we have time for today. Would you care to share any bits of wisdom that you've gleaned from your extensive observation of animals in their natural habitats? And has studying them so intimately given you a clearer understanding of what our own place and role on this shared planet really is?
Yeah, I mean, the most fundamental thing is that all these other creatures want to stay alive like we do. Many of them try very hard to keep their babies alive like we do. They belong to the world as much as human beings belong to the world. And it is wrong and dysfunctional and bankrupting at many levels to just be pushing them off the edge of the earth and pushing them out of existence. They are wonderful beings who are just trying to exist. And our view of ourselves, our perspective of ourselves is incredibly distorted. We think that we are the measure of everything and that nothing else matters besides humans. And that will come back to hurt us, I think, but that's not the reason to appreciate that we are here with many, many wonderful living companions on this planet.
Yeah, we'll appreciate them, why we still have them, and hopefully everyone working toward trying to do what we personally can to make sure that the animals have the space that that they deserve, because I think we humans have been usurping their space and their resources for too long. Before we close, though, just very briefly, I know that in early June this year, you joined Greenpeace in the Arctic waters of the coast off of Norway on a special mission. Would you just briefly tell us a little bit about what that experience was?
Yes, well, that was all about the climate changing, because in the high Arctic, the climate is changing very rapidly. And fish that have been normally caught north of Europe in the Barents Sea are moving north. Codfish and redfish and some of the other commercially important fish. So these gigantic fishing boats that are really floating factories, they are now fishing at 80 degrees north latitude for cod. And this, to me, I thought was stunning. The intensity of the fishing up there has gone up by a factor of 10 over about the last 15 years, because there are now enough fish there to make it worth the while of these boats. They're catching them approximately 3,000 pounds an hour. And, you know, it's just amazing that there are codfish at 80 degrees north latitude in the very high Arctic, actually north of where we saw a polar bear. We saw boats catching cod. This is not the way it has been, and it speaks of very rapid changes. So we were trying to advance a conversation about not fishing everywhere in the high Arctic until we could work out an agreement to leave at least 10% of the seafloor undisturbed by these nets that just plow everything up and break the corals and make a big mess of the seafloor.
Well, I'm glad there's people like you out there doing that. I'm very sorry to say that we're out of time now,